Hey everyone, welcome back. Ready to take a deep dive with us?
Always.
Awesome. Today we're going to be looking at Roper v. Simmons.
Oh, wow.
A landmark Supreme Court case.
Ugh.
This one really delves into a pretty intense question.
Yeah.
Can we as a society really sentence someone to death for a crime they committed as a minor?
That's a big one.
Yeah.
It really gets to the core of
it does.
How we think about justice in our country. And
for sure. And this case goes way beyond just this one specific crime.
Oh, right? Absolutely.
It makes us examine how our justice system views culpability, punishment.
When it comes to young people.
Especially when it comes to young people.
Yeah.
So to really like unpack all of this, we're going deep.
Okay, let's do it.
With the majority opinion, we've got a dissent from Justice O'Connor, another dissent from Justice Scalia, and a concurrence from Justice Stevens.
Interesting to see.
Really interesting.
Those different perspectives on such a
it really is.
Great question.
Yeah, and it's fascinating too because they go beyond legal precedent, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
They talk about how our understanding of youth and culpability has evolved.
And how that impacts how we interpret the Constitution.
Impacts how we interpret the Constitution.
Yeah, which is so interesting.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so let's get into it.
Okay.
Let's lay out the basics of this case.
Yeah.
Christopher Simmons, 17-year-old high school student.
Okay.
He planned and committed a murder.
And it wasn't just any murder. This was brutal. Simmons, along with two younger friends, broke into a woman's home, tied her up, drove her to a bridge, and threw her off. She died.
It's really, it's a chilling case for sure.
Really makes you think about the premeditation.
Absolutely.
The fact that he had actually talked about wanting to kill someone beforehand,
you know?
It makes you question, does age really matter when we're faced with such a calculated act?
Yeah. It's a really complex question. And what makes it even more complex? Well, Simmons believed his age would shield him from the consequences.
Right.
This idea that young people...
That teenage sense of invincibility.
Sometimes have, you know. It really adds another layer to this whole thing.
It does. Now, the case itself hinges on the Eighth Amendment.
Okay.
Which bans cruel and unusual punishment. But that's where things get a little tricky.
Right.
What's considered cruel and unusual isn't set in stone. The court has recognized that this concept evolves alongside societal standards of decency.
It's kind of like, think about how we punish theft even, you know?
Right.
Things that were acceptable 100 years ago or more.
Definitely not acceptable now.
Maybe even 50 years ago, we would think, are totally unthinkable now.
And this idea of evolving standards, it gets applied to the death penalty itself.
Oh, okay.
The Roper case builds on previous cases like Atkins v. Virginia. That case prohibited executing people with intellectual disabilities.
Yep.
And then you have Thompson v. Oklahoma, which protected those under 16 from capital punishment.
Okay, so Roper v. Simmons takes this a step further and says, no executing minors.
Right. The majority opinion was written by Justice Kennedy, and they pretty much just say, this is unconstitutional.
Wow. So what was their argument? What was the basis?
The majority really focuses on these inherent differences between teenagers and adults.
Okay.
They point out that juveniles, because of their immaturity, impulsivity, and the fact that they're so susceptible to pressure from others, just can't be held to the same level of responsibility as adults.
It makes sense, right? Like, think about all the things we don't let teenagers do because we just know they don't have the same judgment as adults.
Exactly.
We don't let them vote. We don't let them serve on juries. Even things like making major life choices, they need guidance. The law already recognizes these limitations in other areas of life.
Right. So it's not that big of a leap to say that, hey, maybe this applies to criminal justice as well.
So do they also look at whether the death penalty actually deters crime when it comes to juveniles?
Yeah, they question that too, given teenagers', you know, less developed sense of consequences.
Like they might not fully grasp the weight of their actions, the permanence of it all.
Exactly. And the majority drew a strong parallel to that Atkins case, pointing out that both national consensus, AND, the court's independent judgment, led to the ban on executing people with intellectual disabilities.
So they're seeing a similar pattern here, a growing awareness that certain groups just shouldn't be subject to the death penalty.
That's right. And that's where things start to get really interesting because not everyone on the court agreed with this categorical ban.
Okay, so who disagreed?
Well, Justice O'Connor, while she agreed that age should definitely be a factor in sentencing, she wasn't on board with a complete ban on executing minors.
So she saw it as more of a case-by-case thing.
Exactly. She argued that while teenagers might, you know, generally be less mature than adults, there are always exceptions. She believed in assessing maturity and culpability individually, you know, trusting juries to weigh those factors appropriately.
So for her, a hard and fast rule at age 18 might just be too rigid, too black and white.
That's her main point, yeah. And this actually echoes back to the Atkins case. O'Connor supported the outcome in Atkins, but she felt that intellectual disability, because it's so, you know, clearly defined, presented a much clearer case for a blanket ban than just youth.
It highlights the challenge of, like, drawing those lines in the law, you know, when you're dealing with human characteristics that aren't always so easy to categorize.
Yeah, it's tough. And then, of course, we have Justice Scalia, who, as you might imagine, had some very strong opinions on this.
Oh, I bet. So what does Scalia have to say about all of this?
Well, his dissent, it's a pretty scathing critique of the majority's reasoning. He really takes aim at the court's reliance on this idea of evolving standards of decency.
So he wasn't buying the whole, like, society's changing, we need to change with it argument.
Not at all. He argues that if a majority of states still allowed the execution of minors at the time, how can the court just claim there's a national consensus against it?
So he's basically accusing the court of imposing its own moral judgment rather than sticking to what the people, through their elected representatives, have decided.
Yeah, you could say that. Scalia was a big believer in sticking closely to the original meaning of the Constitution and was really wary of the court acting like a super legislature, you know, making policy instead of interpreting the law.
Right, right. So this case really highlights that fundamental tension in legal interpretation. Like, should courts stick rigidly to the past? Or should they try to adapt to changing societal values?
Exactly. And it gets even more interesting because the majority opinion actually cites international laws and treaties that prohibit executing minors.
Oh, wow. So they're bringing in a global perspective.
Yeah. And while those international laws, they aren't technically binding on U.S. courts, the majority saw them as kind of confirming they were on the right side of history. Remember, back then, the U.S. was pretty much the only developed country that still allowed this practice.
So they're kind of saying, hey, the rest of the world has moved on. Maybe it's time we catch up.
Exactly. But you can imagine how that went over with Scalia.
Oh, yeah. I bet he wasn't thrilled about that.
He was vehemently opposed to using international law in this context. He firmly believed that American law should be rooted in its own traditions, not shaped by what other countries are doing.
So we're seeing this clash between global norms and American exceptionalism playing out right here in this case.
Absolutely. And it's a debate that has implications far beyond just the death penalty.
Right. It raises questions about America's place in the world, the role of the courts, how we define justice itself. It's big stuff.
Definitely. And we can't forget about Justice Stevens' concurrence. He wrote a really interesting opinion that emphasizes this idea of the Eighth Amendment as a living document, yep. Something that evolves along with our understanding of what's cruel and unusual.
So he's saying that if we were stuck with the meaning of the Eighth Amendment as it was understood back in, what, 1791, we'd still be allowing practices that today we see as barbaric.
Exactly. Our understanding of things like child development and psychology, even the very concept of justice, has changed so much over time. And the courts have a responsibility to interpret the Constitution in light of those changes.
So he's basically saying the Constitution needs to keep up with the times.
That's a good way to put it. Now, here's where I think this case gets really powerful for anyone listening, even if you're not a legal scholar or anything. This case isn't just about legal technicalities. It's about fundamental questions we all grapple with. What is justice? How do we balance accountability with the possibility of rehabilitation, especially when it comes to young people?
It really forces us to confront our own beliefs about the nature of childhood, right? Like, at what point do we say someone is old enough to fully grasp the consequences of their actions? And even if a young person commits a terrible act, do we believe in their capacity to change?
Those are the big questions. Roper v. Simmons really opens up a whole world of questions about how we structure a just and equitable society. Questions that have implications far beyond just this one case.
So it's like this case is a springboard for a much larger conversation.
Exactly. And in the next part of our deep dive, we're going to explore what happened after the Roper ruling. Did it actually change the way we treat young offenders? Did it spark any lasting reforms? Stick with us and we'll find out. Okay, so we've talked about the arguments in Roper v. Simmons, but what about the impact? What happened after this decision came down?
Right, like, did it actually change things?
Well, yeah, it did. The most immediate consequence, I mean, anyone who'd been sentenced to death for a crime they committed as a minor, they were granted new sentencing hearings.
Wow, so the death penalty was completely off the table for them.
Completely. That was it. No more death penalty for those cases.
That must have been pretty life-altering, you know, for those individuals to suddenly be given a second chance.
Oh, yeah. I mean, imagine that, going from death row to having a possibility of, you know, maybe someday getting out. But the impact goes way beyond those individual cases.
Okay, so how so? How did Roper change the broader landscape of juvenile justice?
It really reignited this whole conversation about juvenile justice. It wasn't just about the death penalty anymore. It was about whether the entire system, the way we approach young offenders, needed a complete overhaul.
So are we talking about rethinking, like, the philosophy behind juvenile justice altogether?
Exactly. The court's emphasis on those differences between juveniles and adults, their less developed brains, their impulsivity, you know, their potential for rehabilitation, it really had a ripple effect that went way beyond just capital punishment.
It's like the ruling kind of laid the groundwork, legally and morally, for advocating for a more humane approach to dealing with young offenders.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Roper became this touchstone for arguments against really harsh sentencing practices, even in cases that didn't involve the death penalty.
So did the case actually lead to any concrete changes in the law? Like, did states start changing their juvenile justice statutes to line up with the Roper decision?
They did in some cases. For example, some states abolished life sentences without parole for juveniles. You know, they recognized those sentences just totally ignored the possibility that a young person could grow and change over time.
It does seem kind of contradictory to sentence someone to die in prison, no chance of ever getting out, when the whole point of Roper was to emphasize rehabilitation.
Right. And that's exactly to, you know, kickstart. It wasn't just about specific sentences. It was about prompting a wider reevaluation of how our justice system treats young people.
So did Roper actually lead to, like, a decline in the number of kids being tried as adults? Did it shift that whole thing?
It's hard to say for sure if there's a direct causal link, but there has been a trend in that direction. The Roper decision, along with, you know, a growing awareness of the needs of young people, it's definitely fueled this movement to keep more young offenders within the juvenile justice system where they can get those age-appropriate services.
Which makes sense, right? If the law is acknowledging that young people are different, then the system itself should reflect those differences.
For sure. Roper v. Simmons can be seen as a part of this larger movement, pushing for a more just and humane approach to juvenile justice, one that recognizes the potential for change.
But I imagine there was pushback.
Yeah.
Right? Not everyone was happy with the court's decision.
Oh, yeah, of course. There were and still are people who argue for a tougher approach, for harsher sentences. Some say that Roper went too far, that it ties the hands of prosecutors, you know, and doesn't consider the victims enough.
Yeah, it's a tough issue for sure. Lots of strong emotions on all sides.
Absolutely. And it's really important to acknowledge those different perspectives. The debate over juvenile justice, well, like a lot of things in law, it just doesn't have easy answers.
So where do we go from here? What are the big questions that Roper v. Simmons leaves us with?
It definitely sparks debate about how we balance punishment and rehabilitation, you know, and how much weight should we give scientific evidence when making legal decisions, and how do we even define adulthood?
Like, at what point do we say someone is an adult in the eyes of the law?
Yeah. These are complex issues, and Roper really forces us to confront them head on. And even though this case was decided a while ago, it's still super relevant to our conversations about criminal justice reform today.
For sure. It reminds us that the law is always evolving. You know, and our understanding of human behavior is constantly changing, too.
And those two things have to work together.
Exactly. Roper reminds us that even in the face of really awful crimes, we have to keep asking those tough questions about culpability, about punishment, and about the possibility of redemption, especially for young people.
It challenges us to think deeply about what it really means to create a justice system that is fair and just and humane.
So this deep dive into Roper v. Simmons has been a really eye-opening journey. You know, we've explored the arguments, the different opinions, the lasting impact of this case.
It's a case that really sticks with you. It makes you think critically about how we treat young people in the eyes of the law.
And as always, we want to leave you with something to think about, a question that goes beyond the specifics of what we've talked about today.
Mm-hmm.
So here it is. If, as Roper v. Simmons suggests, the law should recognize those differences between adults and juveniles, what does that mean for other parts of our society? How should that understanding change not just our justice system, but also our schools, our healthcare, our social services?
It's a big question, but it's one worth asking.
Yeah, it really does. It makes you wonder if, like, Roper's kind of a stepping stone to bigger changes, not just in the legal system, but, like, in how we support young people overall.
I think so. Like, if we're saying, hey, young people's brains aren't fully developed, they're more impulsive, more vulnerable to being influenced, shouldn't we factor that into, you know, every part of their lives?
Exactly. Not just when they get in trouble, but, like, when we're talking about education, healthcare, all of that.
Yeah. That's huge. Roper says justice isn't just about punishment, right? It's got to be about understanding. It's about giving young people the support to make good choices.
It's almost like we have to rethink what it means to really care for young people.
I think that's where it gets interesting, you know, because this case, it goes beyond just the law. It asks us, what do we believe about young people? What kind of society are we building?
It's like a call to action, to look deeper, to create systems that, you know, help young people grow.
Totally. And I think that's a really powerful message. Roper v. Simmons, it's not just a legal case. It's a starting point for thinking about justice, about youth, about building a better future.
Well said. I mean, this deep dive, it's really been eye-opening. We've covered so much ground, all the different arguments, the context, the impact.
It's a case that stays with you. You think differently about how our legal system sees young people.
And as always, we like to leave our listeners with something to ponder, right? Something that kind of goes beyond what we've talked about today.
All right, lay it on me.
So here it is. If, like Roper v. Simmons says, the law should recognize those differences between adults and kids, what does that mean for the rest of society? Does it change how we think about education, healthcare, even our personal relationships with young people?
That's the big question, isn't it?
It really is. And it's something for all of us to think about. Because Roper isn't just about changing the legal system. It's about changing how we see and support young people. It's about creating a future where everyone has a chance to thrive.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. It's been real.
And we'll see you next time.